Leg coming, that's okay, we can just come back afterwards, that should be fine now. So, now I would like to continue on the gradual training. Yesterday we had a look at the qualities of the Buddha. We're saying that the beginning of the gradual training is the arising of the Tathagata, the Buddha coming into existence. That is how the gradual training actually starts. And the idea with a Tathagata coming into existence is the idea that right view comes into existence. Right view arises in the world, that the right way of seeing things that comes into being, right? Before that, it's as if there is no right view. Somebody has to see reality first, and then once reality has been seen, then right view is available in the world. And when it's available, that means that other people can also be told about this right view, and then things start to happen from that point of view. So you can see one of the nice things about the gradual training here is that it is really just the Noble Eightfold Path. It is an expanded version, if you like, of the Noble Eightfold Path. So what we're seeing at the beginning here, we're seeing, first of all, right view coming into existence, right? This is kind of the beginning of the Noble Eightfold Path, the Tathagata of the Buddha coming into existence in the world. So this is why the Buddha has all these qualities, right? Because basically it's about his awakening, what that right view, to a large extent, what it actually consists of, and what it actually means. Now, once the Buddha has arisen in the world, then the next thing that happens is that the Dhamma arises in the world, right? The Buddha sees the truth, he starts to teach others. As I was saying yesterday, once you know that you have the answer to this problem that everybody is looking for a solution for, right? Everybody wants to find happiness, everybody wants to find an end of suffering. You know you have the answer to that. Of course, then compassion arises. And from that compassion, then comes the teaching. You start to teach people that. You want to share that solution because you know that people will be interested in this. So this is what happens next. Once the Buddha has come into existence, the next thing is the Dhamma coming into existence. The Buddha sharing his understanding. That's what happens now. And this is how it is described. It's kind of a bit unusual, perhaps. But if it is unusual, it's always interesting because it means there's something to be discussed, something to be contemplated. So this is what it says here. He declares this world with its gods, its Maras, its Brahmas, this generation with its recluses and Brahmins, its princes and its people, which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. He teaches the Dhamma good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the right meaning and the right phrasing. And he reveals a holy life that is utterly perfect and pure. Right? So this, you can see, this is a Dhamma coming into existence here, like what you're seeing here. And he declares, Pakkaseti, means like to make known, right? To make shine forth in the world. This Dhamma is actually what it means. He makes these things known, what he has realized. And what he makes known, and this is kind of weird, right? This world with its gods, Maras and Brahmas. Why are they talking about Maras and Brahmas here? And of course, the idea, as I was saying before, one of the things about the Buddha, when he sees the truth, that he understands all of existence. It's not just an understanding of the human realm or whatever, but it's a full understanding of all existence, all the potential rebirth, all the possible happinesses, all the possible suffering that you can have. And only by understanding the complete picture can you kind of decide what is the right way to approach this, right? Should we get out of it? What should we do? Should we try to find a realm where we can be happy forever after? Was that young man who wanted to live forever? He disappeared. So, right, you can kind of come to these kind of decisions. Is it possible to live forever, for example? So this is what this is about. So this actually, even though it's not said there, it is implied here that this includes rebirth, it includes karma. Because what is the point of talking about these different realms of existence unless it is about rebirth? Otherwise, it's just a kind of theoretical curiosity. There are some other beings, but nothing to do with rebirth. It's only in light of rebirth that these things actually are interesting and they actually gain some kind of meaning here. So what does it really mean then? Is that the Buddha is showing us what the universe is like, right? Knower of the world, Loka Vidura. This is what this is about. So similar to what we're seeing before in the qualities of the Buddha. And this generation, right, with its recluses and Brahmins, these are the Samanas and the Brahmanas. Samanas and the Brahmanas, is this what this means? So why is that mentioned? It's kind of obvious, right? You see all these ascetics wandering around and the Brahmins wandering around. What does it mean that the Buddha declares this? It seems quite, you know, he doesn't have to declare it. Everybody can see it with their eyes, right? It sounds a bit strange. And of course, again, what you have to do here, you have to try to realize from the Buddha's point of view, is that there is this, just like today, there is a world with different religions, different teachers, different ideas, different philosophies. And the question is, who has got it right? Who has got some of the things right? Who has got everything completely wrong, right? There's a few of those as well around, but completely wrong. And then the Buddha is able to distinguish between the different teachings, where they lead, what kind of qualities they have, whether they are in line with Dhamma or not. So this is what this, I take this to mean. It's not entirely obvious. It needs some kind of interpretation. But he understands, basically, the various philosophies and ascetics and Brahmins in the world. That is important, of course. And that's why the Buddha, on his way to his awakening, he rejects some of the claims that exist in there at that time and then goes his own way as a consequence of that. If you think back, you remember the Buddha goes through all the ascetic practices, right? And the ascetic practices are quite likely to be similar to the Jains. The Jains did all ascetic practices. So for a while, it looks like the Buddha was almost like a Jain in a sense. He was following the Jain path. That is part of the understanding that these things don't actually lead to awakening. Asceticism, severe asceticism, is not really the answer to this. This is part of the Buddha's understanding. It's princes and its people. Again, should really be its devas, its gods and its people. Sometimes I think the translation here are actually quite good, but they're not as often. There's no such thing as a perfect translation. So there are always slightly other ways of looking at things. And which he has himself realized with direct knowledge. And this, of course, is kind of a crucial issue here. This whole samsara, rebirth, karma, the understanding of the various different kind of philosophies and religious teachings, all of that comes from the Buddha's direct knowledge. This is not dogma, right? Usually we talk about religion being dogmatic. Dogmatic means that say, this is the truth, and regardless of what you say or if you show me something different, this is still the truth. Give me any evidence you like, I don't care, this is the truth. That's dogma, and that of course is problematic. And one of the reason dogma is problematic is precisely because it doesn't really allow for any evidence to the contrary. I don't know how much you know about European history, but if you don't know a little bit about European history, back in the Middle Ages in Europe, they ended around the 15th, 16th century, right? That's when kind of the so-called Enlightenment age started. To the Renaissance started in Europe, and of course that when that began in Europe, there was a lot of conflict between the church. At that time, the church meant the Catholic Church. It was very, very powerful. Was united with all the leaders, so there was no real distinction between church and leadership. Secular leadership, not really secular, the leadership in Europe. All that was kind of intermixed with each other. And then the scientists started to come around. First of all, Copernicus, who said that actually, the Earth goes around the Sun. Not the Sun that goes around the Earth. The Earth goes around the Sun. And then you had Galileo. Galileo was saying the same thing. And then the church reacted very strongly to this. It wasn't really interested in the evidence. The church, they said, no, this is our teaching. The Sun goes around the Earth, not the other way around. So whatever you say is no good. And then they put Galileo under house arrest for about 30 years or something, even though he was a great scientist. And that is dogma, right? It's your dogmatic. You don't allow the evidence to count for anything. And that is not really the Buddhist one here. The Buddhist way is always to take into account evidence, always to try to look at the facts. This is really the appropriate way of doing things. And that's why I said yesterday that the idea of rebirth, the idea of karma, these are not dogmatic teachings. They are, from the Buddhist point of view, from the internal view of the Buddha, they are experienced things. These are things that have been seen and realized. Of course, if you have realized something, it's no longer a dogma. It becomes the truth. From our point of view, it may be an article of faith, but then eventually, hopefully one day, we can see these things for ourselves. So this idea that this is realized with direct knowledge is very, very important and very significant, because it gives it a different flavor from many other philosophies and religions, perhaps, as well. It's not speculation, it's not metaphysics and all this kind of stuff. So then, he teaches the Dhamma, good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Right? When you practice the Dhamma, it's good. It makes you feel better. It doesn't make you feel worse. It makes you more happy. It makes you have less suffering. All the way to the very end. It has this very positive teaching, which always is about happiness. And it's something you can see for yourself right here and right now. It has the right meaning and right phrasing. Sa-atta, sa-vyanjana is the part of Pali words. And the meaning here of atta means also like the goal, right? There is a real goal there, the right goal, the goal which is something actually worthwhile having, the goal that everybody wants, the goal which is happiness, ending of suffering, which is the fulfillment of the meaning of life, what the meaning of life is all about. this is the right kind of meaning, the right goal, the right purpose. And of course, very interesting as well, that the phrasing is right as well. It's not just that the teaching has the right meaning, going to a good place, but the Buddha is here saying that the phrasing is significant. And what that means, of course, is that when the Buddha speaks the Dhamma, he does so with great care. He does so with great consistency, to make sure that when we read it afterwards, we can actually trust what we're seeing there. He's putting a lot of effort into getting the phrasing right. That means that every word has some significance, right? As long as we can feel relatively sure that we actually have the word of the Buddha, then the phrasing, everything is significant when we read these things. And he reveals a holy life. This is the Brahmacharya. You can call it the spiritual life, perhaps, if you want to. That is utterly complete. Complete is a better translation than perfect. It is utterly complete and pure. Paripurna means complete in all aspects. It's not missing anything. You don't have to go to the 10 paramis. Somebody asked about the 10 paramis yesterday. If the Buddha's teaching was not complete, then you might have to get into the parami, but because it is complete already, don't have to worry about those paramis. What you find in the four Nikayas is enough, and actually there's a lot there already, and if you can practice those teachings, you're fine. No need for any bodhisattva path, no need for any of that kind of stuff. Just get on with the practice, basically. So, this is what the Buddha declares, right? And then what happens? Well, once we have the Buddha and the Dhamma, the next thing to come is the Sangha, right? So the Sangha has to arise. It's always the same sequence. The Buddha, then the Dhamma, then the Sangha. And this is the next thing we will see here. The Sangha coming into existence. A householder or householder's son, or one born in some other clan, hears that Dhamma. Or hearing the Dhamma, he acquires faith in the Buddha. Possessing that faith, he considers thus, household life is crowded and dusty. Life on board is wide open. It is not easy while living in a home to leave the holy life or the spiritual life utterly complete and pure as a polished shell. Suppose I shave off my hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness. On a later occasion, abandoning a small or a large fortune, abandoning a small or a large circle of relatives, he shaves off his hair and beard, puts on the yellow robe, and goes forth from the home life into homelessness. The Sangha has come into existence, right? That is how the Sangha starts out. So, somebody comes along, hears that Dhamma. It's quite strange. Sometimes you wonder about these Pali words, right? And as I said, everything has meaning. So when you read something like a householder or a householder's son or one born in some other clan, right? If everything has a meaning, then what does that mean? Because it sounds like it's been over the top. Isn't it enough just to say someone hear the teaching? What all about this stuff about householder and householder's son and that kind of stuff? It doesn't seem like a bit over the top. But actually, again, everything does have a meaning. The meaning here is that a householder, this was kind of the establishment at the time of the Buddha. The householders, they were the pillars of society. These were the people who had done well for themselves. They had their own house with a large extended family. Often they would have workers and slaves and all kind of people in the household. They would often have their own field. They would have a craft. And there would be, these were kind of the establishment at that time. So the point of this is to say that even people who were at the top of society in those days, they also went forth. Right? Going forth wasn't for the losers. Going forth wasn't for all the poor people who didn't have anything to eat. Going forth wasn't just because you wanted to have a good doctor, because the Buddha had a good doctor. Right? Going forth was an honest search for real happiness. And it was irrelevant what kind of background you have, because the happiness on the Buddhist path is just so much more completely irrelevant what kind of background you have. And it reminds me, when I'm saying this, it reminds me of a nice story. This is found in the Vinaya Pitaka. I think this is the kind of the monastic rules and guidelines set. And in this story, there is this monk. He's sitting in the forest. He's sitting at the root of a tree, right? Just in the forest somewhere. And he's sitting there closed, with his eyes closed, and saying, "Oh, aho sukhang, aho sukhang." Right? Sukha is happiness, right? Aho is like, oh, what happiness. And as he's sitting there saying, aho sukhang, at the root of a tree, these other monks go walk by, right? And they see this monk sitting there saying, aho sukhang, and oh, maybe he's going a bit nuts, you know, sitting by himself in the forest like that all the time. And so they are a bit afraid for him, so they go to the Buddha and say, oh, we saw this monk, Bhatia was his name, he was sitting at the root of a tree saying, aho sukhang, we hope he's okay. Actually, what they said actually was that, oh, he's probably sitting there. He came from a very, very high family. He was the son of a king. And because of that, this monk, oh, he's just thinking about all the pleasures of the royal household. And that's why he's saying, aho sukhang. And then the Buddha, of course, he knows what is going on. So he says to somebody, well, please go and get Venerable Bhatia so we can ask him about this. So this man goes and he gets Venerable Bhatia, and then Bhatia comes to the Buddha's presence, and all the other monks are also there. And the Buddha says to this monk Bhatia, that is it true that you are sitting at the root of a tree saying, aho sukhang, aho sukhang? Yes, that is true. So, and he says, well, why are you doing that? What is the point? You know, what are you doing that for? And then his answer is that when I think back to the royal household and all the problems, all the chores, all the work I had to do, I think, well, now I will have here, I'm sitting at the root of a tree, meditating peacefully, I've given up all attachments for the world. He's an arahant, right? And I think, wow, what joy not to have to live in that royal household. Right? So this is kind of the idea. The idea is that the Dhamma is kind of, it doesn't matter what kind of worldly background you come from, the Dhamma is a level of happiness way beyond anything you can have in the world. Yet it's so easy to get attached to worldly things, but it doesn't actually, it doesn't really compare. So this is the point of this passage here. It is about even if you are part of the establishment, right, still you go forth. And then it has this little thing about someone born in some other clan. Well, this would then also mean anyone else. It's not just the people in the establishment. Anyone is, of course, welcome to ordain. But it's just a point that is being made. That's how I read this passage. Different people read it probably slightly differently. That's what I read when I see this. So, you hear that Dhamma, right, from the Buddha. And when you hear that Dhamma, you acquire faith in the Tathagata. Right? You acquire faith. And this is one of those things that the Pali word is sadha, can be translated as confidence, as faith, as conviction. There are different ways of translating that. And this is what happens when you hear the Dhamma. Right? You think, wow, this is just so true, right? Or you reject it. This is so wrong. And you walk away. There's another possibility. But many people recognize this because it actually is part of our own direct experience. You know what craving is. You know what ill will is. You know that these things are problems, that they create problems in the world. And when you hear the Buddha expounding on these things, you can recognize your own life in those teachings pretty much straight away. So faith arises. And of course, the most powerful faith, why the faith in the Buddha arises so easily, is because of the congruence between the way the Buddha actually is, the way he acts, and the teaching that he gives, right? It matches. And this is one of those, I think, very important things in life, is that very often it is not enough just to read the suttas. You can just read the suttas, but unless you have some kind of living example that exemplifies how the suttas are to be lived in real life, somebody who has actually practiced this for a long period of time and exemplify that in their conduct. It's when you see that, that it really starts to take off. You hear the beautiful teaching and you see the example. The two going together is very, very powerful. occasionally you hear about people who didn't really have an example. All they did was read the suttas. And their confidence is so strong that all they do is this work on the basis of the suttas, and they actually have practiced the path from there. But such people are incredibly rare. The vast majority of us need some kind of living example to really be able to fully grasp the message and to see that it actually can be done, right? When you follow the path, this is the result. But of course, seeing the Buddha would have been very powerful. You would see something. And just the example of the Buddha is almost is a living proof that something else is possible in this world. You can see the quality shining through, and we think, wow, is that possible to be like that? How is that possible? It seems impossible to be like that. How can anybody be consistently so kind, consistently so selfless, consistently so giving? How is that possible? Right? And then you hear the teaching, and you start to think, yeah, maybe it is possible after all. And your faith and confidence is arises as a consequence of that. And that is why also we then are happy to take on board, at least initially, the idea of things like rebirth, because you are getting confidence in these teachings. So, possessing that faith, he considered thus, household life is crowded and dusty, life gone forth is wide open. So I don't know if your household life is crowded and dusty. Crowded and dusty, especially in those days, it would have been very crowded. Even today, household life is much more crowded than monastic life. But in those days, you read the suttas, it says things like, you sleep in a bed crowded with children. It's like everybody had, you had one big bed, everybody was sleeping in the same bed. That's what it sounds like sometimes. But generally speaking, household life is much more crowded, right? You have a family around you and these kind of things. And if you live the monastic life, often you have like a cootie in the forest. And because it is crowded, it is also dusty. Dusty here is a metaphor for attachments and desires, right? So you know what it's like when you live in a household, you're very close to each other. And because you are close to each other, you're always rubbing up against each other a little bit. And because of the attachments involved and the family life, it takes very little for you to sometimes to get a bit upset, and all kind of things happen when you live so close together in a household. So this is the nice thing about the monastic life. It says here that it is wide open. Wide open is here the opposite of crowded and dusty. You remove yourself a little bit. There is less attachments involved in that. You have more space to breathe. You don't feel that people are always rubbing up against you. And because of that, you have more perspective and you have more ability to stay cool in your life as a monastic as opposed to household life. This is one of the reasons why monastic life is more conducive to practicing the Dhamma. Right? And this is kind of the next thing here that comes here, is that you consider this, and then it is not easy while living in a home to leave the holy life utterly complete and pure as a polished shell, precisely because of the attachments and the rubbing up against each other in the household life. Monastic life is more conducive to this. You're more withdrawn, more getting out of the complications of ordinary life. That is why you can do this. Sometimes I hear lay people say, oh yeah, lay life is the real path, right? Because it's more difficult. Well, it's too difficult, right? This is the problem. Even as a monastic, it's difficult enough. In lay life, it's incredibly difficult. There are so many advantages of being a monastic. You can still practice well as a lay person, but don't think that it's a faster path because it's more difficult. It doesn't really work like that. And the reason why the Buddha lays down the monastic path is precisely because it is the ideal way of practicing the Buddhist teachings. I have to admit, if I was a layperson, I don't know how I would practice, right? Probably would be one of those really laggards if I was practicing as a layperson. Sometimes I'm actually quite grateful that I found the monastic life, because it has enabled my practice in a much better way because of that. So, because it is hard, he decides, well, suppose I shave off my hair and beard. Okay, so nuns, you can cut, the beard is not necessary. So, It's male oriented, right? It's kind of based around monks. That's why it's in this way. It doesn't mean that nuns are not welcome. You put on the oak, yellow is a bad translation, ochre robe, brownish ochre robes, and you go forward from the home life into homelessness. And on a later occasion, he does just that. He abandons a small or a large fortune, abandons a small or a large circle of relatives, shaves off the hair and beard, puts on the ochre robes, and goes forward from home life into homelessness. So this tells you that you leave all the worldly stuff behind, abandoning a small or a large circle relative. It sounds a bit harsh, right? You just say goodbye to your family and say, you know, but they are, of course, it doesn't mean that you never see them again. You may see them again, and you may have some discussions with them about Dhamma or whatever. And this is one of the great things about having a monastic in your family. So if ever your son or your daughter wants to go forward, you should say, hooray, finally, a monastic in our family, right? So it's a wonderful thing when that happens, because the quality of your interaction between a child and a parent, or between siblings or whatever, if one person is a monastic, the quality goes up. Quantity goes down, the quality goes up. You've got to decide what you want to have, quantity or quality. What's the point of having all this kind of low quality quantity? Right? It's kind of silly, isn't it? Much better to have a little, just not so much quantity, but more quality. Yeah. That's what I say. Yeah. That's what I feel in the interaction with my family, is that much more quality now, and I'm very happy, much more happy about that. And I think so are my parents, actually. Yeah. It took them a long time to realize that, but eventually they kind of got around to understanding that this actually is a better now. So, then you go forward. The Sangha comes into existence. And there's also another thing going on here. And this is maybe not entirely obvious, but when somebody decides to go forward, right, even if they don't decide to go forward, even if they just decide to become a layperson, sometimes it's not really possible to go forward because of whatever commitments or whatever it is that you may have. But what is going on here is that the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path is coming in here. Samma Sankappa, right? Sankappa means, often translated as intention, but it means like purpose. It means like aim, right? Suddenly you have the right aim. You start off with, the Buddha tells you what the right view is. Then you take that view on board, so you get right view, you want to hear the Dhamma, and from that right view, your aim in life changes. Right, I'm sure you all know what I mean. Once you kind of get on the Buddhist path, your values change a little bit. What your priorities in life are, it starts to change a little bit. Right, you put more emphasis on kindness, put more emphasis on morality, you put more emphasis on the quality of life rather than the quantity of life. It doesn't matter so much whether you have three cars, right? The three cars are not so important anymore. One car will do. More important to have a good heart and to do these kind of things. So your emphasis, your whole outlook starts to change. And this is what is going on here. So your aim changes. And because your aim changes, that is why you go forth. It is an interesting point of view, because very often when you hear that Samma Sankappa translated as right intention, it is not entirely clear what that means, right? Why does right intention come from right view? Sometimes we say intention of metta or non-ill will or intentions of renunciation, right? What does it actually mean? Well, it means that you are aiming for these things. It doesn't mean that they are already in your mind, that you already have metta, you already have renunciation. But if aim is there, and this is that's what your purpose becomes. This is what you want to go for. And because your aim is there, the next aspect of the path then becomes the morality, right? Because your aim is to have metta. Well, of course, if your aim is to have metta, the first step towards that is morality. And of course, also here, the aim is also renunciation. So you become a monastic. If you take on the five precepts, you're already renouncing a little bit. There are certain things you can't do when you take on the five precepts. That is a certain kind of renunciation also. We're moving in that direction here. Okay, So you go forth, and then what happens when you go forth is the following here. Having thus gone forward and possessing the bhikkhus, training and way of life, so that bhikkhus training and way of life is just the kind of the you know, the what you do as a monk basically, and meditate and go on alms round, that kind of stuff, and you know, try to be kind to other people, that kind of thing. The bhikkhus training and way of life. And then comes the morality. So now we're moving from samma sankappa, right aim, to samma kammanta and samma vacha. It's kind of strange here because in the Noble Eightfold Path, samma vacha comes first, then samma kammanta. Here is the other way around. Samma kammanta, which is right action, comes before right speech. So I'm not sure why there is that reversal there, but it doesn't really matter. I think the point is that these two things, they come roughly together. That may be the point of that reversal then. So what happens is that abandoning the killing of living beings, he abstains from killing living beings with rod and weapon and laid aside, and conscientious, merciful, he abides, compassionate to all living beings. Right, so this is a little bit like the first precept, not to kill any living beings. I'm sure you recognize that. But it's more, right? It's more complete than the first precept. And this is what is interesting about this. There is a lot here about compassion, right? Being merciful, having the right attitude toward the living beings. And indeed, this is really the point also of the first precept. The first precept itself, it is based on the idea of where you are coming from, what is motivating you. This is actually the most important part of the first precept. What is the driving force that drives you to act? That is actually what decides the morality or the ethical value of any particular action. The Buddhist idea of ethics is very interesting, and is kind of very, it is not a dogmatic system of ethics. It is based on common sense, really. So the Buddhist idea of ethics comes from a very simple reality here, and that is the reality that we all feel, right? We all have feelings, and those feelings, either they are good or they are bad. Either we like them or we don't like them, right? Either it's pain or it's pleasure. Either it's suffering or it's happiness. Sometimes it's kind of in between, but it tends to be these two kind of extremes. And from that very basic thing that we all feel, you can derive an entire system of ethics just from that. Because if we feel things, it means that we have preferences. We want the nice feelings, we don't want the bad feelings, right? And because we have those preferences, because we feel and we have preferences, if I give you what you don't like, if I give you pain, then of course that is unethical, because I'm giving you something that you don't want. If I give you something you want, if I give you happiness, then I'm giving you something positive, I'm doing something good, then it's ethical. So the whole system of ethics is based on this idea that beings of all kinds, they feel. And when you feel, you have preferences, and therefrom, everything else flows from there. And this is the idea here as well, and this is why it says compassionate. Because if you have compassion for other beings, it means that you care about whether they feel pain and suffering or whether they feel happiness and pleasure. And because you care about that, you act towards them in such a way that you try to promote their happiness and pleasure in life. So you may ask, the question that comes from this is how can I know that people are all, what people's preferences are? How can I know what people's happiness is and what people's pain is? Sometimes it's very hard to distinguish these things. And this is why sometimes Buddhist ethics is phrased in a different way. It is phrased in terms of where are you coming from? What is your motivation when you are dealing with other people? Right? So if your motivation is pure, if you are coming from compassion, if you're coming from metta, if you're coming from wisdom and all these kind of things, it means that in your heart You want the other person to be happy. Yeah? You want to support the other person. You want to reduce their suffering. Yeah? And that then becomes another way of looking at Buddhist ethics, because we cannot always be 100% sure how the other person will react. At the end of the day, we have to look at our own motivation. And as long as our own motivation is pure, then even if we make a mistake, then we are still doing what is ethical, because at least we are trying our best. So this is how Buddhist ethics works, right? It's actually a very logical, very consistent, very a very rational system of ethics, which is very often very hard to find often elsewhere in many other kind of systems, if you like. So, and from that, then comes the idea that the first precept, or the first about not killing, is not just very simply not killing. The important point here is, where are you coming from? What is driving you, right? And the assumption is that if you kill somebody, you're coming from defilements inside. But you can see here how there is a lot of leeway, right? It's not just about not killing. Really, what matters is the motivation. And because of that, it gives us a lot of flexibility in how to deal with difficult ethical matters. Euthanasia, indeed, there's a very big topic around the world. I don't know if it is a big topic in Singapore. Is it because of Singapore as well? Talk about euthanasia? It is, anyway, has been in the Western world for quite a while. And the question is about whether, you know, assisted suicide and these things are good or bad and that sort of thing. But from a Buddhist point of view, well, we will just ask the question, where are you coming from? What is driving you? And if everything is based on compassion and kindness and wisdom, then it's okay. If it is based on defilements, then it's bad. It's not black and white. It's, you have to look at individual intention to understand whether something is ethical or not. It's a very, very beautiful system of ethics, because it doesn't have this black and white idea. It actually looks at the complexities of the situation and draws lines that are commonsensical and rational based on that. And this is why this is one of the most beautiful things in Buddhism, is the system of ethics. And often this is misunderstood, because often it is like, okay, 5 precepts, that's the right way. If you break them, then it's bad. But it's not as simple as that. It's much more, quite a lot more complicated. And the other factor here is that because our motivations very often are not black and white, it's not either you are compassionate or you are really nasty. Sometimes it's somewhere in between, right? A little bit of compassion, but maybe not entirely pure. So instead of talking about ethics as black and white, in Buddhism it's much more appropriate to talk about it as gray, right? We are somewhere in between. And what we are trying to do is to do things a little bit less dark, a lighter shade of gray, what we're trying to do, right? So when you practice, don't think, don't go to, you know, somebody ask, oh, is this good karma or is it bad karma? Well, usually it's neither absolutely good or absolutely bad. Usually it's somewhere in between. And your job is to make it a little bit better, a little bit lighter shade of gray, right? So it's a little bit less bad and a little bit more good. To make karma that is entirely good is very, very hard, because it means it requires an entirely pure mind. Now, how many of you have an entirely pure mind? How often do I have an entirely pure mind? Right? It's not so often. It's very hard to have an entirely pure mind. You have to get into some very profound meditation, and you come out of the other end and you feel, wow, you know, that is when you have a really, really pure mind. But most of the time, we are somewhere in between. So we cannot really make absolutely pure karma, nor is also very difficult to make very dark karma. How often is it that we do things out of pure hatred? It's not so often, right? So we tend to be somewhere in the middle with these things. All of these things are very important to understand, I think, in terms of karma, because actually the Buddhist ideas are quite nuanced and quite carefully considered, and that's what makes them so useful and so powerful as an ethical teaching. So, we try to be compassionate, right? We try to do our best, and this is what it is saying here. Of course, a very important factor here as well is the fact that It is not just, we can see it, about not killing, right? It's also about actually being compassionate. That's what I was saying before today. When we live in the world, we follow the five precepts, but at the same time, we actually actively try to do good. And that actively trying to do good with as much intention as we can possibly have, that actually tends to lift us up and give us much more power in our meditation practice. So that is the first precept about abstaining from killing living beings. Then we have the abandoning, the taking of what is not given. He abstains from taking what is not given, taking only what is given, expecting only what is given. By not stealing, he abides in purity. So this here is the, again, is the monastic life, right? That's why it is so much emphasized on what is given here, because it's the biggest training, but of course it is very similar for lay people as well. There isn't any major distinction. You can see one little nice thing about this one is the idea that expecting only what is given. What you can say what that means is actually wanting only what is given. That is another way of translating that. So you don't even want anything which isn't given to you. You don't have this desire inside of you to maybe, you know, that might lead you to steal one day. You're not even interested in that at all. So you take that purity one step further, and it also kind of starts to engage with the mental purity as well. And it says there, if you live in this way, it says that you abide in purity. So the idea here is that if you steal, it makes you feel impure, right? There's something about stealing that fear makes you feel impure inside. It reduces your sense of this gladness that comes from just feeling pure and bright and blameless. Stealing actually tends to destroy that. Which is interesting, because sometimes stealing, oh, it's only a small thing, right? Killing is bad, okay, we can agree on that, but stealing is only a small thing. But the Buddha is making the point here that actually, if you do that, you will feel a sense of impurity by doing that. And of course, that is going to be a big block in your meditation practice. Now, the positive side of not stealing is, of course, generosity, right? So before we have been compassionate compared to killing, now it's generosity compared to stealing. It is not mentioned here, and the reason it's not mentioned is because generosity is such an important part of the Buddhist path that usually it is mentioned separately here, because it is because of the importance of the idea of giving here. Right? So generosity has such a powerful... But as we can see how, obviously, stealing and generosity are exact opposites. Stealing is something you do because of greed, very often, not always, but very often it is. Where generosity is the exact opposite, is the giving up of greed and relinquishing and sharing of the things you have. So you can see how these things are almost exactly opposite to each other. Here, too, also... With stealing, remember there are shades of grey. There are stealing which is really bad. There is stealing which is less bad. And perhaps even there is types of stealing that are not all that bad at all. So if you steal purely because you are greedy, right? That is a bad kind of stealing. But what about Robin Hood, right? Is that a little bit less bad. It's still bad because you're stealing. But this case, you have an intention, you're not taking it for yourself so much. You're stealing from the rich and giving to the poor. Still not so good, right? Because you're stealing, but a little bit less bad. Now imagine a situation where you are perhaps very poor. You're really, really poor and you're starving. You have to feed yourself. Maybe even worse, you have a small child that you have to feed, right? And you know that unless I can get some food to this child, it might die. And then you steal something for that child, and perhaps you even have the intention to repay it later on when you have the means to do so. And again, you can see how the different shades here of stealing is important that we understand. It's not all the same. It depends on your motivation. What is driving the stealing is very, very important here. So, okay. Now we come to the last one of sammakamanta, of right action, and this is abandoning in celibacy. He observes celibacy, living apart, abstaining from the vulgar practice of sexual intercourse. So, in celibacy is not a very good translation. What this means really is like if you like sexual conduct, so you abandon all sexuality and you observe non-sexuality. Living apart, abstaining from not the vulgar but the common practice. Gammo means literally of the village. So it's kind of what is commonly done, is what the meaning of this is. So the idea here, and again, because we're talking about the monastic practice here, this is why this is a part of this. This is obviously different from the five precepts, right? So here you have to think monastic practice. But the idea here is that what we are trying to do on the monastic path and also on the lay path is to encourage meditation practice. And if you're going to encourage meditation practice, and you're going to have success in meditation, remember that the sensual pleasures in the world, not just sexuality, but any kind of sensual pleasure, whatever it is, it's always about going out into the world. It's about finding pleasures that are external to yourself, right? Whereas the pleasures of meditation are internal. It's about cutting off the external world and going inside of yourself. You cannot both go outside and inside at the same time. So because you can't do these things at the same time, you're trying to cut back on the external things and move internally instead. So this is why this is emphasized on, especially on the monastic path. So that you can actually move in a different direction. If you find a lot of happiness in these external pleasures, and of course sexuality is one of the most powerful such pleasures, because if you find a lot of happiness there, it means that you will have some attachment there, right? It's impossible to find a lot of happiness in a certain area and not have any attachments. And because you have attachments, when you try to abandon it in meditation practice, you can't. If you think that the body is going to give you lots of happiness, you can't let go of the body. Because letting go really means letting go. It is as if the body disappears. It's as if you are no longer in charge of the body. It's as if the body is no longer yours, right? It's a complete giving up. And that complete giving up can only happen if you have no attachment there. So this is why on the way into samadhi and into the jhanas, the giving up of the body is such an important aspect. And the only way you can do that is by loosening the attachment to the pleasure that you get through the five senses. So this is what this is about. And often people don't understand this, right? Maybe especially in the West, sometimes I despair at people's ability to grasp these kind of points, because to me it is fairly obvious. You can't go outside, inside at the same time. You have to make a choice at a certain point. And then that means that you have to detach yourself from certain of those pleasures. But no, in other words, we have to have both kinds of happiness, right? Only then is the spiritual path really working. You can't just kind of throw away all these other happinesses. Then it's kind of pointless. But you're not throwing away anything. All you're doing is gaining something better, right? There's nothing really lost in that. It's only something gained. And this is really the issue at stake. So this is what is going on here. And this is why also when you go on a meditation retreat, often you have like five precepts, right? Is to kind of withdraw a little bit, at least temporarily, from that world of the five senses. Okay, so now we come to right speech. Samma vacha on the path, and I'll probably go through this now. If I don't get through this, then there's no chance we will ever get anywhere in the sutta. So I'll go fairly fast through this, and if you have any questions about it, we can talk about it later on. Then. So, abandoning false speech, he abstains from false speech. He speaks truth, adheres to truth, is trustworthy and reliable, one who is no deceiver of the world. Right, so this is musavada, which is lying, And so you abstain from lying. But not only, you will notice here, do you abstain from lying, but you are actually deliberately reliable, trustworthy, somebody who doesn't deceive the world. Sometimes people become like lawyers, right? They say, oh, okay, now how can I get away with almost lying, not quite lying, right? So I don't break the precept. But please don't become a Buddhist lawyer, a kind of a lawyer Buddhist, whatever it is. Please don't think in those terms. The idea here is to be trustworthy and reliable. The idea is to go in the exact opposite way of lying, not to find some kind of loophole where you can get away with almost lying. That's missing the point. You want to be trustworthy. You want to feel that when people talk to you, they can rely on your word as being an accurate representation of what is going on. That is the right way of speaking here, right? So, and then you are heading, and the more trustworthy and reliable you are, the better it is, and the more you are fulfilling right speech here. So, what that really means is, especially sometimes when we lie, is because we are embarrassed about something, we have something to hide, right? We don't want other people to know about it. And that is when it's tempting to not tell the full truth. But sometimes you just have to be honest about things and say, okay, unfortunately that happened, but I'm not going to lie about it just to protect myself, or just because of some silly kind of desire. The classical example in the suttas is where you are in a court of law, right? And the presiding judge or whoever, or the opposition or whatever it is, asks you, did you do this? And you did it, right? But you say, no, I didn't do that. And you have, before that, you have sworn on the Dhammapada, right? You swear, I swear on the Dhammapada in the Buddha's name, I will tell the truth, the only truth and the full truth and nothing but the truth or whatever it is. And then still you lie, right? That's pretty bad, because you are there swearing on something which you consider very holy and very important to yourself. You're lying in full awareness. Why? Because you are trying to protect yourself or protect a friend or to make some money or whatever it is. And that is when it is really, really bad. And in those situations, it is much better to own up and get it over with. Okay, it's going to be painful, let's face it, but at least it's going to last only a short time, rather than something you have to carry with you into the future and make endless complications for you in this life and in the future life. But also remember, with lying, it's like with everything else, it depends why you are lying, right? Are you lying in the court of law? Or are you lying because somebody is not ready to hear the truth, perhaps? You're just coming out of compassion. I can't tell them the truth. A classic example is the story that Ajahn Brahm told me. And he may have told it here as well, or to the, when he goes to Singapore. And that is a story of a man who is in hospital. He's lying in the bed and he's waiting for the bypass operation. And in the bed next to him, and there's another man. He's also waiting to have a bypass operation. And one day, his friend, right, he become friends after a while because of living in the same hospital room, his friend goes in for the operation, right, and then he doesn't come back. So his wife comes for a visit, the wife of the man who's sitting in the room, and he asks his wife, what happened to my friend? And his wife happens to know that that friend actually died during the bypass operation. But she is afraid that if I tell my husband, he will become so worried that he too might die in the operation. So she tells him, he's okay, I'll tell you, I'll talk about it later on, right? So basically she is lying. But because of the situation, she's coming from a sense of compassion, possibly also a bit of attachment, right? It's her husband after all. But coming from a sense of compassion, in that kind of situation, lying is not really bad, right? If you can get out of it by kind of turning the kind of conversation aside, that is, of course, perhaps even better, or at least just as good. But in those kind of situations, lying is not really a problem. It's where you're trying to protect yourself, where you're trying to gain something from it. We're doing it out of all these unwholesome motives. That is when it's bad. So remember, this is through and through Buddhist morality. It's always about why you are doing things. That is what really matters. Okay. Abstaining from malicious speech. She abstains. Angie, can we go on for another 10 minutes? Yeah? Okay, great. I just don't want to kind of So I'm not sure what you have on, so that's, I just want to make sure everything's okay. So abandoning malicious speech, he abstains from malicious speech. He does not repeat elsewhere what he has heard here, in order to divide those people from these. Nor does he repeat to these people what he has heard elsewhere, in order to divide these people from those. Thus he is one who reunites those who are divided, a promoter of friendships, who enjoys concord, rejoices in concord or harmony, delights in harmony, the speaker of words that promote harmony. Right? So, again, this very nice idea that we try to have harmony in the world rather than division. We live in a world where people divide so quickly, and we form into groups, and then we form into subgroups, and we split apart from each other, and all of these things are happening so much all the time. And a lot of the reason for that is because it's a lack of harmony. But harmony is actually one of those very important things. Sammagga, or sammagi, is the Pali word for this. Harmony is very important for meditation and happiness in life. Only when you have a sense of harmony do you have a sense of gladness and piety, and meditation becomes possible. So very important. So the ability to seek that harmony, always seeing the good sides of people, right? If somebody is kind of, they really upset me, what should I do? We can remind them, instead of saying, yeah, they're really bad people, right? If you do that, you're splitting them apart. Instead of saying that, you say, well, listen, they have other sides as well, right? Well, they were going through a hard day. Or, poor person, they are deluded. They don't really know what they are doing. So instead of pulling people apart, you help people to become united and have harmony. Of course, the worst thing here is if you're doing this out of anger or greed, right? Splitting people apart, saying bad things about others because you hate those other people and you're deliberately kind of causing schisms and problems. That's when it's really bad. But it's very, I don't know, I find this very kind of touching and beautiful, right? Speech that promotes harmony in the world. It's so important in an age when there's so much problems in the world. Yes, we could go out and blame the Muslims and say they are, or Islam is bad, or some of these terrorists are terrible people. But actually, instead of doing that, sometimes it's more useful to ask ourselves, why is this going on? Why, are they deluded? How can we kind of help the situation by trying to understand rather than just condemn all the time? If we condemn, we could create more schism, more problems. Let's protect ourselves. Let's not allow terrorists to destroy our lives. But at the same time, let's try to solve these problems in a reasonable manner. They are also human beings, right? They also have feelings. If we had been under the same influence as they have been, maybe we too would have been terrorists. Right? This happens. Remember, we are all like the boat on the ocean, and we all depend on the currents and the winds, depending on which way we go. We all have the potential inside of us to be terrorists. Terrible thing to say, but it's probably true. And because of that, we can have compassion and understanding, even for those people who do terrible acts in this world. In this way, create less problems in life. And what a wonderful thing to do if we as Buddhists can be promoters of harmony when there are so many forces in the world that go in exactly the opposite way. So let's try to do better, as good as we can at the very least. Okay. Then we have abandoning harsh speech. He abstains from harsh speech. Speak such words that are gentle, pleasing to the ear, lovable as go to the heart, are courteous, desired by the many, and agreeable to the many. Right? We don't shout at each other, don't swear at each other. We say kind of words that go to the heart. Haddayagama. Going to the heart, quite literally, that are courteous and lovable, that people like to hear. Right? Sometimes we have these people who speak in very gentle and nice ways, who is always a pleasure to hear them speak because they speak in a good way. And what a wonderful thing that is when that happens. And remember that one of the things about speech, we talk a lot, right? right now I'm talking a lot, you are not saying so much, but because I talk so much, I really have the possibility of creating a lot of harm, right? And I could sit up here and be really stern, and I could shout at you and say many bad things. I could do that. But I also have the other possibility. I have the possibility to actually say something useful, something gentle, something kind, something which actually would promote something, which actually would get someone somewhere. I can give you a gift through my speech, or I can give you something really detrimental, something bad that will cause you pain and suffering. And each one of us, we have that possibility inside of us, right? We can give the people around us a gift every time we open our mouth, or we can give them a hard time every time we open our mouth. So remember that. If you treat your speech in that way, it can become a very powerful source for making good karma and for spreading happiness around you. If every time you open your mouth, you remember, now I can give a gift, or I can do something detrimental to the other person. And if you start thinking like that, and you really put intention into that, wow, you can make good karma really, really fast. Because we talk quite a lot, because a mouth is such an active instrument in our life, it means that we have a lot of opportunity to make good karma, or make bad karma, or just be completely neutral and not do anything at all. Last one. Abandoning idle chatter. Idle chatter is much better than gossip. He abstains from idle chatter. He speaks at the right time, speaks what is fact, speaks on what is good, speaks on the Dhamma and the Vinaya. Vinaya means like training, discipline. I don't think it's quite right. At the right time, he speaks such words as are worth recording, reasonable, moderate, and beneficial. Right? Don't talk too much about all the nonsense in the world. Sometimes you kind of despair at all the nonsense that is going on, and all the kind of silliness, and people take a lot of interest in all of these kind of things. But instead, you talk about things that actually do matter. Things that actually do promote happiness in the world. Things that actually lead somewhere. Things that have an end. Words that are worth recording. Nidanamati literally means are to be treasured, right? Words that we put away because they are to be treasured, like the word of the Buddha that we're reading right now. They are reasonable. They are connected with what is considered, what are reasonable words. Basically, it's reasonable. Moderate, they are not, don't go on endlessly, they have a certain, they have an end to them, I have to be careful, otherwise I will fall into that offense quite soon by being immoderate, because it's been going on for quite a while now. And the last one, they are beneficial, right? This is the last one there, they actually are of benefit. So again, very beautiful, right? The idea, the emphasis of our words are on what actually is useful in life, instead of all the other stuff that is going on. Of course, we are friendly to each other, we say words and friendliness and all these kind of things, but there is, you know, there's no need for that endless kind of gossip and idle chatter that often goes on. There's a nice list in the sutta, there are, I think, 30 topics of that, of kind of idle chatter, kind of talks about heroes, talks about, you know, kings and ministers, just like we talked about today. Heroes is like perhaps, kind of movie stars or that kind of stuff, and you know, politics, all this kind of things. A little bit of politics is interesting because sometimes you can see these things from a Dhamma perspective and they can be useful. A lot of the time it's just idle talk here. So that is plenty enough for now. So I've gone a little bit over time, sometimes that is unavoidable. So please enjoy your afternoon. And we'll see you back at 8 o'clock again, Angie? Yeah, so 8 o'clock again this evening, we'll see you back again. Let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha. Yeah.
Well, this is really good, actually. Whatever it is, it's great.